Good evening, everybody. This is Jim Breeling. This is our first call-in in May, and May is a very, very special month in borderline land. In 2008, the House of Representatives of the U.S. Congress, by a roll call vote of 414-0, adopted House Resolution 1005. That resolution supports May the entire month as Borderline Personality Disorder Awareness Month. So we have a rare unanimous support from the House of Representatives to make what we can of May for promoting awareness of borderline and the new hope that is there. And those who heard last week's call with Beth Brodsky, or actually 2 weeks ago, there was an interesting question. What was the most difficult part of the DBT method to teach to psychiatrists? And she said the different view of borderlines is not being manipulative and not having a hopeless disorder, but one with hope and good prospects for remission. And that relates to the awareness. So that is something that we can all contribute to in a way. And on the NEABPD website, there are now Borderline Awareness Month bracelets and also a very attractive and engaging awareness poster available for ready downloading. So I hope everyone will make a point of doing a number of things in May to promote awareness of borderline personality disorder with benefit of our new understanding of the hope for improvement and better understanding of the people who have the disorder and their families. Turning to our speaker tonight, Geraldine Downey, we are honored to have her with us tonight. She comes from Ireland, raised there, received her bachelor's degree there, and immigration worked like it should. She came to this country, got her graduate degrees, master's and doctorate at Cornell, went on to positions in Michigan and Denver, where in engaging with prisoners, she first became interested in borderline, then came to Columbia, where she pursued a basic research program on social rejection sensitivity with benefit of a major NIMH grant. Very productive and established herself as a leader in the field. And in looking at how we would grow the field, one of the things was, since we have relatively few places that have borderline personality disorder research programs, the way of growing by having leaders in the field train new people was limited, and the other way was to draw people in with relevant work who had not focused explicitly on borderline. And happily, Geraldine was very responsive to that step and received a 5-year major NIMH R01 grant to do that extension. And not only was this an important contribution, but there's some other things she brought to this research, and this is notable, a real team building, bringing in other investigators to collaborate on this, and also not just having a few studies with a few simple measures, but parallel research programs within this to really provide a breadth and depth. She had her laboratory measures of social rejection that you'll see in the PowerPoint this evening, but she also had concurrent field research using diaries as to the people of experience. One of the things with the lab measures is they can be very precise, but do they have validity beyond the laboratory? So she had a remarkably, having multiple measures and then across these domains to check on it, which is a really notable and exciting and impressive strength. And she is also quite a mentor. And one of the things that she is working on is psychophysiological, the biological aspect of measures. And one of her mentoring successes here is Chris Crew, who we will be hearing from in June. He received a diversity supplement from the Recovery Act for that research, and it has gone very well. And just recently he received a Presidential Teaching Award from Columbia that not only is it an unsolicited surprise, very well deserved, but it comes with some real money. So this is, I think, a tribute to both Chris and to Geraldine as the mentor in encouraging him so successfully to do well. In addition to her research recognition, Geraldine has been valued within the university for her wisdom and has served as chair of the psychology department and also as an assistant provost in administration. And we've mentioned Chris. And with that, let me stop and turn it over to both Geraldine and Chris Crew, who is with her tonight, for their presentation. Remember, if you have questions, email them in to neabpd@aol.com. Do it as soon as you can. Don't hesitate. We already have 8 questions in, so it'll really help me if you can shoot your questions in as fast as possible that we can organize them to try to cover everything and still conclude at our scheduled 9 o'clock time. So let me stop, get out of the way. It's all yours, Dr. Downey, and would be soon to be Dr. Crew.
I'm delighted to have this opportunity to talk to the NEA members and also to have been invited by Jim to do this is a great honor. Jim brought me in to the area of borderline personality disorder by inviting me to probably the best conference I've been ever at the University of Minnesota, where I also met Perry Hoffman. And what was so wonderful about that conference is that he gathered people, as he said, who were on the borders of doing research that was relevant to this disorder, but weren't for the most part involved in doing that research. And many of us went on to do so. It was a really stimulating conference because we got to hear about other research that was going on. We also got to hear from clinicians who were involved in trying to develop effective treatment. And most especially, we got to meet and hear from and interact with family members of people with borderline personality disorder and people with the disorder themselves. So it was the kind of conference that really brought together all of the expertise that are required to move something forward. And it has been sort of my model of how to do things ever since. I consider it extraordinarily important to have the researchers and the community who is affected by the disorder work together in a way so that all of us have an understanding of how we can come up with effective interventions. So let me tell you about some of the research that we have managed to do in the past decade. The first 5 years really took the form of doing the pilot work that led us to the grant that Jim so ably shepherded through and helped us to shape in ways that ended up leading it to be funded. So the research was done in conjunction with a team, including Kathy Bernson, who's now at Gettysburg College, where she's a professor, Karen Kaufman, who's at Kent State University, and Eshkol Raffaeli, who has at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. And I have here with me Chris Crew, who will soon, one hopes, be a professor himself. But he is doing some of the more exciting new research that Jim alluded to on the neural basis of borderline personality disorder as some of the symptoms affect learning. So what I'm going to do is to focus on our work on the role of rejection in triggering the intense anger or the rage that's characteristic of borderline personality disorder, and that's one of its symptoms. But before I start, what I want to say is that I've given you the web link to our papers, and they're all available at the social relations website, which is on the first page here of the PowerPoint. I'm now going to move on to the second PowerPoint, the second slide, and that gives you the list of the DSM-4 criteria for BPD. Five are required for diagnosis. Now, as you no doubt already know, some symptoms are primarily interpersonal in nature, such as frantic efforts to avoid abandonment, which is criterion one, and some are primarily emotional, such as inappropriate, uncontrolled anger or rage, criterion seven. There's also problems of impulse control and of suicidal behavior and non-suicidal self-injury. Now, of course, these various types of symptoms occur together, and problems in one area may influence how and when problems in other areas are expressed. And our research has focused on exactly this issue. So we draw on the rejection sensitivity model, which I've been working on for many years from a basic social personality perspective, to test the links between rejection concerns as captured in criterion one and anger as captured in criterion seven. Now, the approach that we take in this research is compatible with a new approach to investigating serious mental illness that Thomas Insel, the NIMH director, announced this week, which will focus on the cognitive and emotional processes that underlie symptoms and symptom clusters, as well as the neural basis and some of the genetic basis. But what I'm going to do is tell you about two studies that we use to uncover the contingency or the if-then link between rejection and rage in the lives of people with borderline personality disorder. Next slide. Research on rage in borderline personality disorder has shown that this aspect of the disorder is one of the most stable over time. And studies of the daily lives of people with borderline personality disorder find evidence of more extreme, sudden switches between quarrelsome and non-quarrelsome behaviors in people with the disorder than in healthy controls. But what's missing so far from the empirical literature on rage in borderline personality disorder is a consideration of the context in which it emerges. Next slide. However, in the clinical literature, there's a significant emphasis on rejection as a trigger of rage in BPD. So, for example, the DSM-4 states that the anger is often elicited when a caretaker or lover is seen as neglectful, withholding, uncaring, or abandoning. So our goal in the research that I'm going to talk about was to test this clinical conclusion empirically. Next slide. The interpersonal problems that are associated with BPD have particularly serious consequences. People with the disorder describe relationship difficulties and disruptions, the ensuing interpersonal turmoil as among the most common triggers for self-injury and for suicidal types of behavior. And in addition, relationship problems keep people with the disorder from being able to maintain the supportive connections that are known from the research to promote recovery from the disorder. And relationship disruptions are often triggered by the rage symptom on the list that I showed you. So this is sort of what we know from the clinical work and from prior research. And now I'm going to turn to the next slide, which gives an overview of the research that I'm going to talk about today. In both its theory and methodology, the research draws on our prior work on rejection-triggered rage in non-clinical samples. We wanted to test our hypothesis using two very different methods in the same sample, a priming experiment and an experience sampling diary. And so to give you a sense of what a priming experiment is, the basic idea here is we're looking to see if two constructs like apple and orange are connected more closely in some people than others. And in this case, we expect that that rejection, feeling rejected, is more closely connected with feeling angry or enraged in people with borderline personality disorder than in healthy controls. And so that's the sort of essence of the priming experiment, which takes place in the lab. And the experience sampling diary is a diary in which we contact people many times during a day and ask them about their experience at that precise moment in time. And what we want to do in terms of looking at this connection between rejection and rage is look at the extent to which these are found together as experiences in the diary to a greater extent in the borderline people with borderline personality disorder than in healthy controls. But I'm going to explain these in a lot more detail. But first of all, I want to give you a sense of why I originally became interested in this connection between rejection and rage. It's something that rejection normatively elicits in all of us, but there's significant individual differences. And I became very interested in, through work originally with women in prison, in looking at the connection between the experiences of rage that they had that led to violent behavior and that was the basis of their imprisonment, and linking that back to rejection, which many of them described anecdotally as the reason for the behavior that led to their incarceration. Now, that sort of is what got me interested in this question of the connection between rejection and rage. And I worked kind of coming out of this sort of clinical experience to develop a model to explain individual differences in reactions to rejection. And I developed a model called the rejection sensitivity model, and it's been examined very extensively at all different sort of levels, from the neural to the behavioral, in non-clinical samples. So let me just tell you a little bit about the model, which I've outlined on the next slide. So the basic idea of the model is that the experience of painful rejection in childhood or later, perhaps and probably in conjunction with the biological vulnerability that increases reactivity to the environment, can lead people to hold anxious expectations of being rejected. These anxious expectations are then used to interpret and respond to subsequent interpersonal cues. And among people who are high in rejection sensitivity, cues such as a boyfriend or girlfriend acting distant or a therapist going on vacation can trigger a set of processes that are designed to detect and interpret the extent of rejection threat and to react intensively then to the threat. When the intense reactions take the form of hostility or anger or rage to the perceived rejection, these can be associated with relationship dissatisfaction and breakup. In other words, the interpersonal behavior of rejection-sensitive individuals results in the outcomes they fear: unhealthy, unstable relationships, rejection, and loneliness. And this then, in turn, reinforces anxious expectations of rejection. Now, what I should say is that in some of our recent work, which I'm not going to talk about today, we've sort of uncovered some other reason for the intense anger that or rage that can occur when people who are highly sensitive to rejection perceive that they've been rejected. It turns out that they are often the people who put themselves totally into gaining acceptance in that relationship, and they will put themselves out and self-silence themselves and accommodate in ways that should get them acceptance, and then when they don't get it, that they show the intense anger or rage because of the unfairness that they perceive to have happened. So this is something new that we found, but not the subject of the talk for tonight. But I wanted to just make the point that the anger or rage is often because people have put so much of their efforts into gaining acceptance and then feel that they have been unfairly treated. So let me then just sort of say that we propose, as we move into thinking about borderline personality disorder, that the RS model provides a relevant framework for understanding some symptoms, and particularly some connections between symptoms, given that abandonment fears are one of the criteria for the disorder, and their role in triggering other symptoms is emphasized in the clinical literature. So next, I'm going to tell you how we measure rejection sensitivity. The idea of cue-triggered anxious expectations underlies the core of what we view as rejection sensitivity. And it's operationalized in this rejection sensitivity questionnaire, and I've given you a sample question. So that is, you're in a situation where you approach a close friend to talk after doing something that seriously upset the friend. You're asked how concerned or anxious would you be over whether or not your friend would want to talk with you, and you're asked whether you would expect that the friend would want to talk to you to try and how much you would expect the friend would want to talk to you to work things out. The rejection sensitivity level is calculated by multiplying the degree of concern by the level of expectations of rejection in each situation and averaging across the situations of the measure. The idea in the measure is to capture the sense of threat that's activated in a particular situation. Now, how is this relevant to measure relevant to BPD? What we found is that people who with a BPD diagnosis tend to score very high relative to control or the average person on this measure. The average scores reported by people diagnosed with BPD were above the 90th percentile of a large sample who completed the measure. And that's more than twice as high as the mean for the healthy control group in the study that I'm going to talk about, or than the average person in our large normative sample. So the sort of point here is that people with borderline personality disorder tend to be very high in rejection sensitivity. So that led us to provided some basis for us to expect that they would behave in our studies like people who are high in rejection sensitivity. Now, particularly relevant to BPD, prior research in the rejection sensitivity model, and this is on the next slide, has provided evidence for rejection contingent rage in non-clinical samples of highly rejection-sensitive individuals. So, for example, lab studies have shown that rejection sensitivity predicts heightened cognitive accessibility of rage when primed by rejection, and I'll explain what that means in the as we get to the study. And a diary study showed that rejection sensitivity predicts more conflicts between partners on days after the female partner felt rejected. So in these studies, the rage associated with rejection sensitivity is rejection contingent. It occurs only when rejection cues are present. So I'm now moving on to slide 12. I just wanted to make sure that everybody is on the correct slide before I start to tell you about our research procedures and the sample. So what we did...
Geraldine, a question.
Hmm?
On the rejection, is the resultant subsequent rage directed at the person who is viewed as doing the rejection, or is it just as likely to be directed at other people?
It's in our studies, it could be either. it could be directed at the person who did it, or if that person wasn't around, it could be directed at somebody else.
Okay, so somebody else could be catching the heat for...
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
It could also just be, in some of what we've been doing, is just like when you feel rejected, you also get into a state of feeling enraged and feeling you want to lash out generally.
Okay, I think that was the concern, that people felt like they were taking the heat and had they done something to be responsible. And your answer is no, you may not have done anything.
Not have done anything, yeah. Mm-hmm. It could be just that they're just there.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So basically, what we did was we adapted the theory and methods from the prior work and started to look at it, using the same approach the sample of people with borderline personality disorder. We recruited participants from the community, and we got a lot of help in doing so from the advocacy groups and the support groups, for which we're very, very grateful. We could not have done this study if the groups who work on behalf of people with the disorder and their families had not gotten behind us and helped with the recruitment. We did diagnostic interviews to determine people's eligibility, and we found that many people who seemed through screen interviews to sound like they would be eligible were not. So we ended up interviewing many more people than ended up being eligible for the study. We had participants come to the lab to complete experiments, and we then gave them a Palm Pilot diary to take home and use for 3 weeks. And we intruded in their lives about 5 times a day and got them to complete questionnaires about how they were feeling and thinking right there and then, and what had happened since the last time they heard from us. So we used very few exclusion criteria for our BPD group, so it would be representative of the population in which there, and we know that there's very high rates of comorbid disorders, but the only exclusion criteria we used were no cognitive disorder or illiteracy, no primary psychotic disorder, not intoxicated during study sessions, because we wanted to be sure that the participants in the study were actually engaged in the tasks. For the control sample, we recruited participants who were healthy and high functioning. We required that they had no psychiatric medications or disorders for a year, and that they met less than 3 criteria for any personality disorder, and that they scored it as being high functioning. We ended up, and I'll give you the participants on the next slide, with 45 participants with borderline personality disorder who completed both of these studies, or both of these paradigms that I'm going to talk about, and 40 healthy controls. The mean age was between 34 and 35, and the majority were female. We had a very strong, or about 50% were ethnic minority groups, which is a pretty large representation of ethnic minorities. So let me move now to the priming study, and which is the first of the 2 studies I'm going to talk about. So what we were trying to do in the study is imagine the strength of the automatic cognitive association, or to examine the strength of the automatic cognitive association between rejection and rage. Where what we mean by association strength is the extent to which one construct, such as rejection, facilitates bringing to mind another construct, such as rage, more quickly. So put here, instead of rejection and rage, put apple and orange versus apple and potato. So apple and orange, apple, hearing the word apple should bring to mind quickly orange much more quickly than it would bring to mind potato. So that's kind of what we're trying to get at here. So we measure the strength of association as how fast someone begins to pronounce a rage word when primed or immediately preceded by a rejection word. So here's the procedure. So you should be looking at a computer screen here. Each trial begins with a fixation point in the middle of the screen. So you see three stars. Next slide. Next, a prime word is flashed either slightly above or below these fixation points for a brief amount of time, for 90 milliseconds. Next slide. It's then masked by a string of words that cover it up. Next slide. Then the target word, target here, appears in the middle of the screen and remains until participants begin to pronounce it. The participant's voice, next slide, is recorded by a microphone, and the computer records the time in milliseconds between the appearance of the target word and the participant beginning to pronounce it. So what did we use? We used four types of words as both prime and target words, and this is similar to our previous research. They were rejection words, such as reject, abandon, betray, exclude, ignore, leave. Rage words, such as rage, anger, slap, hit, hurt, revenge. And then we use two types of words that we view as control words. Neutral words like map were included to evaluate the possibility that the faster pronunciation of rage words in BPD could be explained by the constant availability or accessibility of rage rather than heightened priming of rage by rejection words. So it may be that that rage or anger words are just always accessible. They don't need to be primed by anything in people with BPD. And we wanted to rule out that possibility by looking at how quickly they begin pronouncing words, or rage words, when they were preceded by neutral words like map. And in addition, non-rejection related negative words like pollute and vomit were included to evaluate the possibility that any effects of rejection primes might be due to the general negativity of these words rather than their rejection relevant content. So the idea here was to make sure that negative words in general didn't trigger a sense of rage in people with BPD, or that the words were not just there all the time and readily available to them. Okay, so we analyzed the data by taking the median or the latency to start to pronounce rage words following rejection, neutral and negative words, and rejection words following rage. So what I mean by this is that we captured how fast or slow people were in beginning to pronounce rage words when they followed rejection words, neutral words, or negative words. And we also reversed we looked at the reverse link between rage and rejection, because we wanted to see if rage triggered people to think about rejection words. And so let me just kind of give you an idea of the hypothesis that we were testing. So on to the next slide. So what we expected was that the connection, the association between rejection and rage would be stronger in people with BPD than in control. So that's sort of the first green arrow the first arrow that's green on this slide. And we expected that there would be no group differences when rage words were followed neutral primes like map, or negative primes that are unrelated to rejection like pollute. And so, next slide, these are the results, and they were consistent with predictions. So what you have here is, in sort of bluer or violet, we have the control group. In purple, the BPD group. We have, for the y-axis, we have the the amount of time, the pronunciation latency, the time it took for somebody to begin pronouncing a word. And it goes from faster to slower. And we have three blocks here. We have the latency, the time it took to pronounce rage words that followed rejection words, as that's the one with the big circle around it, and that's what we were most interested in. The middle block refers to rage following neutral words, and the rightmost block refers to rage following negative words. So as predicted, participants with BPD did start to pronounce rage words significantly faster than controls did when the rage word followed a rejection prime. So the idea here is that thoughts of rejection activate thoughts of rage more readily in people with BPD than in controls. Also, as predicted, the effect was not due to the chronic accessibility or the ready availability of rage words in BPD, because there was no group difference in pronunciation latency for rage words following neutral primes, and the effect was specific to rejection content in that there was no significant group difference in the pronunciation latency for rage words following negative words that were unrelated to rejection. So what this approach allowed us to do quite nicely was just show that there's a specific connection between rage and rejection in people with borderline personality disorder. And this is something that we'd found previously in the general population for people who are high in rejection sensitivity. So let me just sort of show you this final finding here, and that is that it didn't go the other way around. Feelings of rage were not strongly connected to, or didn't trigger feelings of rejection. So there's not a cognitive, so the link between rejection and rage in BPD goes in one direction. We didn't get any group differences for rejection words following rejection primes. So let me just show you, following rage primes. So when people are in a state of rage, they don't then feel rejected. It goes the other way around. The priming study results then show that there's an automatic cognitive link between rejection and rage in people with BPD relative to controls. And in this way, they look like people who are high in rejection sensitivity. Okay, but the important thing is, what does this fairly small difference, it's significant, but it's split second in the cognitive accessibility or the availability mean for rejection contingent rage in the daily lives of people with borderline personality disorder? So I'm going to move on and talk now about the diary study. Do we find this something that we've demonstrated under very nice control conditions in the lab, does that actually have relevance for daily life? So I'm going to move now to the next study. It's again with the same participants, and we looked at them using data that we got from the PAM pilot diaries. So I'm on, just to check in with you, on slide number 28. So what we had people do was for five random times a day for 21 days, the PAM pilot beeped to signal the participant to answer a series of questions. So next slide gives you the perceived rejection scale. So what would happen when you got this beep is you would be asked to rate how much rejection you're perceiving right now. So how much you're feeling abandoned, rejected by others, accepted by others, and that's reverse Gordon. Your needs are being met. We also ask people how much rage they felt, how irritated and angry, how enraged at somebody, how much like they felt like lashing out. And let me just show you in the next slide the mean ratings across the diary period. So so it was a scale that went from 0 to 4, and what we found, again, we have the control, healthy controls in violet, and the people with BPD in purple. And the graphs show their mean daily ratings of perceived rejection and of rage were much higher across the diary period amongst the people with BPD than amongst the people with controls. But what we were really interested in was whether changes in levels of perceived rejection led to changes in level of rage. So the idea here is if you took out what everybody's average level of perceived rejection was, or average level of rage, did what was left, did the change in rage and the change in rejection tend to go up and down? Do they change in tandem to a greater extent in people with BPD than in controls? I'm not going to describe the analysis, the statistical analysis, in any great detail. And I'm just going to move on. If you want to look at it, you can read how we analyzed it. But I just want to show you the figure that gives you the results. So, and this is slide number 33. So what we have here is, in the moment, the level of rage that people experienced in the moment is on the y-axis, and on the x-axis, it tells you, or gives you these scores, minus 1, 0, plus 1, and they 0 is the sort of average amount of rejection that you experience as an individual. And minus 1 is low levels of rejection relative to your mean. It's one standard deviation below the mean. Plus 1 is is high levels relative to your mean, and it's one standard deviation above the mean. So the basic idea, what we see here is that the predicted values of the dependent variable, which are how much rage you feel, when participants are perceiving more or less rejection than their average across the diary period, we see that perceived rejection is associated with a nearly significant increase in rage in the control group, as is consistent with our prior research in this phenomena in the non-clinical samples. So the control group is again blue, and the BPDs are in purple. And so what you see here is that the effect, the slope, is much exaggerated amongst participants with BPD. The elevated rage that people with BPD experience compared to control seems to be entirely dependent, however, on the extent to which they perceive themselves as rejected at the moment. When they appear less, when they feel less rejected than their typical level, their level of rage is no different than it is for the control group. But when they feel higher levels of rejection, they feel much higher levels of rage than do the control group. So basically, there's a very strong connection between feelings of rejection and rage in people with BPD. And we know also that the average level of both is higher in people with BPD. Now, so that's the basic result of the diary study. And next, what I want to do, which I think is really for us some of the most exciting finding, is linking the experimental study, the lab study data, with the diary measures. And what we wanted to do here was look at as our dependent measure, as our outcome variable, the pronunciation latency for the four prime target pairs that I already talked about. Rage following rejection, rage following neutral, rage following negative, and rejection following rage. So there are the diary or the groups that we had looked at in the priming study in the lab. And what we were able to do was take those four categories and use them or ask the question of whether we took the diary groups or we took the diary results and we split the diary results the people in the diary results into those who had a very strong a rejection rage contingency, and these are the yellow or the orange people, and we compared them to those who had a very weak rejection rage contingency, the green people, and we asked whether the green people looked slower or faster than the orange people in terms of their the pronunciation latency of their scores in the priming study. And basically, to sort of cut to the chase here, what we found was that there was a very nice match between the diary study and the experimental study. So the people who showed a strong, the orange people who showed a strong rejection rage link in the diary study were the people who in the lab study were much faster in pronouncing the rage words when they followed rejection words. So basically we got congruence between the two between the two different kinds of approaches to looking at this rejection rage contingency. We found no differences between the orange and the greens in any of the other in any of the other cases here. So, what is interesting about this, from our point of view, is this ability to connect the diary work with out in the real life world of people with what we do in the lab, so what I am I've finished now the two studies that I was going to that I had said I would talk about, and what we can conclude from this, and I'm onto the conclusion slide, which is the 36. The empirical support, our conclusion is that empirical support for the clinical notion of rage in BPD is substantially rejection contingent is what we can conclude from these studies. Right now, we're looking at a lot of different other studies, both in the field and in the lab. And one of the things that we've been looking at is whether feelings of rejection are an implicit trigger of non-suicidal self-injury. And we have some nice evidence that this may be the case. So what we find is that when people are feeling rejected and they then engage in non-suicidal self-injury, that their feelings of rejection abate. And this is true for some other kind of negative feelings as well. We've also begun to look at some of the moderators of rejection contingent rage in BPD. And we're looking in particular at self-regulatory competency, which is really sort of captured in, if any of you know, Walter Mischel's delay of gratification studies, in which he got children to wait for a larger reward that they would prefer, like two marshmallows, versus an immediate smaller reward, like one marshmallow, and measured how long they could wait. And so we have tried to take that idea and look at it in terms of monetary rewards. And we have found that in our own research with rejection sensitivity, that people who can delay longer, actually, if they're rejection sensitive, don't show the negative outcomes that we find associated with the disorder, such as or with them being high in rejection sensitivity, such as rage. And what we're wondering, we're about to test in the next few weeks, is whether this measure of self-regulatory competency, this adult delay of gratification measure, can moderate the effect of rejection on rage in people with BPD.
Can I pass on a two-part question? One part is, what are people doing when they're moderating, delaying their response?
What they're doing, they can be doing a lot of different things. And one of the things that they can be doing is distancing themselves, taking themselves out of the situation, and taking a bird's eye view to it. We know that if you get people to do that, they actually can moderate their feelings of anger in other work from our lab. That's experimental work but it's not with clinical populations. Or they can be sort of reappraising it like they did. They can think of it in different ways that allows them to cool down their emotion.
Okay, almost like a timeout. The other part was, are you looking at any brain areas like the prefrontal cortex is putting a damper on emotional impulse?
That's what we have found, that with people who are highly rejection sensitive, that when they see rejection cues, the prefrontal cortex is not activated as much as it is in people with low rejection sensitivity. So it seems like they're not doing the kind of things that. In Kevin Oxner's work, he's my colleague here, he shows people do when they're told to reappraise the situation and make it less threatening or less arousing or distressing. So that's what we think is going on, that rejection-sensitive people are not doing it, but if they can harness these competencies, they will show more activity in the prefrontal cortex.
Okay. Do you know about the work over at Mount Sinai, looking for the kind of to strengthen, if you will, engagement of the prefrontal cortex on dampening emotional responses?
I do. That's actually the work with Kevin Oxner.
Okay.
Yeah. He works with the people in Mount Sinai to do that.
Right. Okay. Great.
The other work that we've been doing is showing that the ability to differentiate between different kinds of negative emotion, not to have them kind of tightly entrained to one another, that seems to predict, or we've found evidence that it predicts against non-suicidal self-injury. But it's more common amongst people with borderline personality disorder to have all their negative emotions going together. So if they don't differentiate as much, they don't say I'm feeling sad versus I'm feeling angry versus I'm feeling frustrated or tired, and to the extent that they can identify these emotions and differentiate amongst them, that seems to protect against non-suicidal self-injury in some of the work that we've been doing, a paper that's just about to come out. So that's also what we're looking at as a protective factor. And then Chris's own work will be on how rejection cues may disrupt learning in people with BPD. It seems as if when they hit these cues of rejection threat, they stop paying attention. They sort of flee from the situation and don't process more the rest of the information in the situation. But Chris will tell you all about that. So anyhow, I'm finished, and I'm happy to take more questions. Did we lose you?
It sounded like hanging up. This service is provided.
Jim?
Hello?
Geraldine, are you there?
Yes. Press number of subconference from 1 to 4 or press star to return to the conference.
Okay, Jim. Hello?
Geraldine, you're there?
Yes, I am. Yes.
Okay, so Jim.
Hi.
Jim, are you there?
What am I doing?
Jim? Hold on a minute, Geraldine, because I'm not sure if we've unmuted everybody. But I also have some questions that came through, so let me go to them. Somehow we lost Jim. I'm sure he'll be back.
Hello?
Oh, Jim, good. Okay, keep going then. Jim? Geraldine?
Yes, I'm here. Yes.
You and I are still here. Let's hope he comes back. But in the meantime, Jim, are you there? Hold on a minute here. I don't know how we lost him. Hold on. Okay, so let me just go through some of the questions that came in. Jim? Nope. All right, thank you for all of you who are waiting here. I'm just going to pull back some questions.
Hi, I'm here. Can
okay.
you hear me?
Yeah, Geraldine?
Yes, I can hear you.
Can you hear Jim?
Yes, I can, yes.
Okay, go ahead, Jim.
Oh, sorry, I hit the wrong button. we got nephrological and clinical questions here. But let me give, what work is there on the development of perceived rejection? How people are looking at intervening with children and prevention and adolescent DBT and rejection sensitivity.
But we haven't looked as much at its development as might need to be done. But what we do know is that that children who, as they move into middle school, to the extent that they get rejected or accepted by their peers, that leads to an increase if they get rejected and a decrease if they get accepted by new peers in the rejection sensitivity. So we view it as something that's learned and through experience. We have not gone back ourselves to look at it earlier in development, but it's very similar and in many ways to insecure attachment, and which is there is some evidence that that's rooted in early parenting experiences, but that there are some children who are much more difficult have much more difficulty in forming secure attachments because they end up or because they have much they're difficult to soothe. So it's probably the early child parent-child interaction as a bidirectional phenomenon that can lead to rejection sensitivity or can dampen it.
Okay, and that's a nice intersection maybe with the social aggression that Nikki Crick has been leading mm-hmm. work on.
Yes, yeah.
Can perceived invalidation be considered a form of rejection in this model? That is, can it lead to borderline rage the way perceived abandonment or other forms of rejection can?
Sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
Can perceived invalidation?
Yes, I think that is actually a very interesting question because that's something that we've been looking at as a predictor of rejection sensitivity. And when this is retrospective data, it's not something that we've looked at prospectively, but it's that kind of an invalidation, conditional acceptance, so you're accepted if you're doing what your parent wants, that seems to be pretty strong predictors, at least in college students, of rejection sensitivity. And so they're talking about when they were growing up that experiences like that predicts rejection sensitivity.
Oh, okay. So the foundation thrust in DBT really has separate support. We're becoming a social media world of telephone and text contacts. And how does one, if you will, set limits and deal with this rejection rage complexity with telephone or text interaction? Any thoughts on that?
It's a really interesting area, and I know that there's an awful lot of concern, especially amongst parents of adolescents, about this kind of online rejection. And I think that it is something that the schools need to take on, and probably like any other things that our adolescents get educated about, or even younger children, that the schools need to sort of work on educating children about how to behave on the internet or through social media.
And what might, from this research, this casts a number of parents, with grown family, daughter or son with BBT, that can we do things to set limits or a framework that would reduce rejection sensitivity, or at least rage when we do get together? Is there preparation or ground rules or guidance that might be helpful there?
Well, I think that one of the things that's helpful is, you know, to get people to understand the model and understand that, as is done in a lot of DBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, that your expectations and your concerns can heighten your awareness of the possibility of rejection, but that you really do need to assess the information and to see if it's something that is really there or not, and that you need to think about how you react to it. So I think that the self-regulation part, the kind of work that Kevin Oxner and the people at Mount Sinai are doing, is really important to bring in. I think it's also, from the point of view of family members or work colleagues of somebody who's highly rejection sensitive, that they give as much possible context for any kind of what might be perceived as negative feedback as possible, and to make sure that they sort of over-explain or rather than taking it for granted that the person will give them the benefit of the doubt.
The question is, have you shown this data to the research participants or others with BPT, and how did they respond?
We haven't shown it to them yet, but what we have done is we've had a session at Columbia where many of the participants are from, and invited people to come and hear about the research as we present it, and that turned out to be very interesting.
Okay, we are past time, and there's loads of questions. We're going to have you back if you would.
Well, I'd be delighted to come back, and it would be a real honor. This has been a wonderful opportunity, and I very much appreciate that all of you have taken your time to listen to our research, and I'm a big fan of this way of linking researchers with people who might want to hear about their research, and I've learned a lot from the questions. So thank you.
Well, we have a lot more. Thank you. And Chris, you could be primed a little bit for an attentive, active audience to engage. Thank you both so much for giving up your Sunday evening for this terrific sharing.
Well, thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Perry.
And I'm looking forward to it in June. So.
Thank you to all of you.
Okay. Bye-bye, everybody.
Okay,
we will have another one next Sunday. Hope you will tune in. Bye-bye. Have a great week.
Bye.
Bye.